Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode here on MyCanonLink.com of the Roundtable, as we sit around and discuss things of importance here, not only in Greenville and North County, but also West Central Ohio. I'm Alex Warner, joined as always by Galen Blosser here on my right, Mike Stugall over here on the left, as we continue to look at different things that hopefully of interest here for your viewers out there. Today we have a very special guest, so I would like to say all rise as we bring in the Honorable Travis Fleeman, Common Pleas Judge here in Dart County. Judge, have a
thank
seat.
You, thank you. You may be seated.
You may be seated. Thank you.
If we don't, what happens?
If we
just ask him.
Court security will get called.
Okay. Probation at the least, most likely. Anyhow, we're here on a dreary, I guess you could say, Tuesday morning here in November, and it's starting to look like late fall out here, isn't it?
Yep, sure.
I think snow showers coming along. So, anyhow, so Judge, let's talk just a little bit. Let some of the people know a little bit of what your background is, where you're from, and hopefully some things that will interest people out
there. Sure. I grew up on a small farm in Clinton County, Ohio. Went to East Clinton High School. Did undergrad at Ohio State University. That's where I met my beautiful wife, Kelly. She's a native of Dart County, went to Versailles High School, and so we began dating in college, got married, and several years later, after practicing law and going to UD for law school, I found myself coming back here in 2009 and taking over the practice of Ray Donatio at the time, and took over his practice and continued to just be active in the community. My wife and I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. And went to Versailles High School, and so we've stayed active in the community, and then obviously had an opportunity to become judge a couple years ago.
Yeah, and you said you went to East Clinton High School, and what kind of a farm were you on?
So it was a small farm. My father was the ag teacher back in the day.
Really?
So my mother worked in the lunch line, so I always teased everybody that, you know, they knew my grades and what I ate sometimes before I did. East Clinton High School, I had 74 in my graduating class. Lees Creek, Ohio has no stoplight, so it's out in the middle of a farm or cornfield. So it's very similar to, you know, rural America that we have here in Dart County. So I felt really comfortable coming back here when we had an opportunity to come back here, and Dart County was always very welcoming to me as well. Yeah.
And you were real heavily involved in FFA then, with your dad being an ag teacher.
I was. So that became kind of my primary focus in high school. I had the privilege of being state FFA president back in the late 80s.
Really?
And I took a year off of college and traveled around the state of Ohio representing the organization, and then going to Ohio State with a major in agriculture economics.
You still have your blue jacket?
I have several of them hanging in the closet. I don't think they fit anymore.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Well, that's interesting. State FFA president.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, one thing I've always had to ask, and then Galen and Mike will jump in here. How in the world does a school like East Clinton, which basically is out in the middle of absolutely nowhere,
Lees Creek.
Mm-hmm. How do you guys get the nickname for your sports teams of the Astros?
That's a great question.
And that's why I asked.
I don't know that I have the answer to it. I know we were teased many times because we really didn't have a mascot, and the emblem on the wall in our gym looked more like a flying meatball than it did an Astro. So we were part of the old KTC conference back in the day.
Yeah, Kent and Trace
conference. And so I'm not real sure where that originated, but it's stuck over the years.
Yeah.
It doesn't have near the history of athletic performances like you have in the MAC around here. But I'm an Astro.
Did you guys ever play Blanchester?
We played Blanchester quite often.
Yep.
So, yes.
I think I had one of your games once.
Okay.
Does East Clinton have a new school building from when you were in school, or they
I don't think so. I mean, they upgraded back in the early 80s. I graduated there in 88, so we were in a new school at that time. I think there's been some expansion since then.
Okay.
But I think, we were in a, basically East Clinton, the school district was broken into two elementaries, one in New Vienna, Ohio, and one in Sabina, Ohio. And then the high school was kind of in between both of them in Lees Creek.
I think my wife had two cousins, both graduated from East Clinton, if I'm not mistaken.
Your FFA.
Correct.
What kids today, Versailles has a great program.
They do.
Greenville has a new instructor. What does FFA do for a young person, boy or girl, if they don't live on a farm? How can they be involved?
I think there's a number of ways that organization has evolved over the last 20 years. Dina Webker is just a fantastic instructor over there at Versailles. It just puts in an incredible amount of time and energy into that program, along with her husband Jeff and the family. I think the FFA offers, if someone can find some kind of agricultural pursuit, it doesn't have to be on a farm. Much like 4-H is open to lots of different options to become a 4-H member, I think the FFA has evolved in something similar to that. People can work at the meat counter at your local delicatessen and qualify for an agricultural occupation or at least practice in that area. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to become involved and have a program or project. But I think the leadership and the extracurricular activities, public speaking, parliamentary procedure, a number of those programs that we are so in need once you're adults, how to run a business meeting, how to get up and speak to people, how to conduct yourself in a job interview, those kind of skills are lacking in the workplace. I think the FFA is a great organization that helps educate someone on some of those skills and gives them the confidence to become productive members of the community.
Okay. Do you think some of the skills you learned in FFA have helped you here?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Public speaking was probably the biggest component that I kind of rely upon, whether it's a prepared presentation where you're, you know, preparing ahead of time what you're going to say, or to speak extemporaneously and think quickly, you know, on your feet and be able to make decisions. I think that exposure was very vital to my occupation now. Part of the material procedure that I mentioned before, the ability to run a meeting and know how to just manage a committee. Those kind of skills, I think, have always been important in the organizations I've been able to be involved in and in the role I have now as well.
Well, I think that background of learning to speak extemporaneously and quick on your feet will fit in quite well with this group of people here today.
Yeah, because we never know what we're going to say.
Yeah, we have no clue what we're saying. How did you decide to go into the practice of law? How did you decide to go to UD to law school?
So, like anybody who watches television, you get inspired by by legal shows. To this day, I enjoy watching Tom Cruise and A Few Good Men, and you enjoy watching that. I grew up with no legal background, didn't have a family or friends that were in the practice of law. I was just, I thought I would enjoy being either a pastor, preacher, or a lawyer. And so
I'm not sure how those all fit.
We won't go into any attorney session. So the law kind of, it was something I was interested in. I did not go into law school right out of college. I actually spent 3 years between undergrad and law school working in the public-private sector, just kind of getting a job, paying bills, learning what it's like to live life. Mm-hmm. And then decided to go back to law school in 1996. I graduated from UD in 99. Had an opportunity to go to UD or UC for law school. My wife was a dental hygienist at the time for Dr. Locke here locally.
Oh, okay.
So we lived just outside of Bradford, Ohio, and I drove back and forth to UD for 3 years while she continued to kind of support our family financially as a dental hygienist, and that's kind of how things evolved in the late 90s for us.
Yeah. So you said then you came to Dark County, well, took over Ray Donadio's practice in 2009. You had a 10-year gap between getting out of law school and there, what were you doing at that point, Don?
So practicing for big law firms. My first practice was in for Jackson and Kelly down in West Virginia. Had an opportunity to go down there right out of law school. Enjoyed that practice. That practice kind of evolved into me coming back to Southwest Ohio and working at Dinsmore & Shohl in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is a very big law firm, international law firm now. And was there until basically 2009 as well, when I had an opportunity to come back here.
My youngest brother was with Dinsmore & Shohl for the start of his legal career and so forth. That is a big firm.
It's a big firm. It's even bigger today.
So we get back to Dark County, so we take over a private practice and so forth. What were some of the things you enjoyed about private practice, and maybe some of the things that, didn't quite suit you?
It was different because at Dinsmore, I was focused on mass tort litigation, so I'm always in the litigation phase and working with major clients, a lot of office work. When I came back to Dark County and took over more of a private practice, solo practitioner approach, now you had to know a little bit about everything, not just focusing on becoming an expert at one thing. So there was a little bit of learning curve there in terms of learning some things. I think I fit in well with the clientele. I grew up on a farm, I grew up in a rural community. Mm-hmm. I think I fit in well there, but just learning the different things. I enjoyed, though, the opportunity to sit in a conference room and meet with clients one-on-one throughout the day and help them plan and prepare. I did a lot of estate work, a lot of real estate work, a lot of estate planning. So it's an opportunity for me to think ahead, to plan ahead, to give them hope and perspective on a plan. I think they valued that. I missed that, quite honestly. I missed that component, mm-hmm. that one-on-one interaction with clients. But I enjoyed that very much. And it was, the transition was, you know, instead of sitting in an office by myself for the most of the time at a big firm, now I'm in a conference room with a variety of clients throughout my day. And mm-hmm. I enjoy that, but it was certainly a transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know I was the client of the good judge here and so forth. I certainly appreciate that plea bargain you worked for me. Got a reduced sentence.
Should have left him there.
Anyhow, yeah. Hey, maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that.
Travis, what were you thinking?
There's a chance to get back at me right now.
The only one you got for us here.
Well, you know, today, police officers, deputies, they have a rough way to go today. I mean, I think here locally they're probably respected, but nationally they've taken a hit. How do you feel about when you have in court, you support the police and our security? Is that a tightrope to walk?
Not really, mainly because I'm not usually the trier of fact, so the jury is in many instances. So I'm not there judging the credibility of what law enforcement did or didn't do many times. My role is to make sure that proper procedures are followed, that due process of a defendant has been supported and honored. But then you leave it to the trier of fact as to whether or not is there sufficient evidence to find them guilty of a crime. Mm-hmm. Sheriff Whitaker and I think have a great relationship. I appreciate everything he's done. I may be viewed as slightly different than my predecessor. I know I have a maybe slightly different philosophy on how a case is handled. Still want to accomplish the same goals, maybe slightly different approach. But I think law enforcement around here, like you agree, I think they're much more respected than what perhaps they are nationally. I think we've got a great group of law enforcement, whether it's on the county level or in our local cities and villages. I see many of them often. They provide great resources to the court and security for the courthouse. So I think we have a great relationship. I appreciate everything they've been able to offer and do to kind of support my judicial philosophy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what is your judicial philosophy? What is your basic, you always go back to?
Sure, and if you sat in my courtroom, you'd probably hear me say this at least on a weekly basis. The legal system, in my viewpoint, is designed to create a change of attitude and change of behavior. And so how do we do that? Now, some crimes require punishment. The crime in and of itself requires an element of punishment. But I think there also needs to be a focus on how do we deter others from committing the same crime, and how do we rehabilitate this person, have a change of attitude or change of behavior, so that they're not committing a crime again. And that's often my message. And then the question becomes, with this particular individual, what's appropriate? What is appropriate punishment? What is appropriate means to create a change of behavior, or change of attitude, sometimes when they themselves don't want to? And so how do we accomplish that becomes maybe the biggest challenge for our legal system.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what piqued your interest in becoming common pleas judge? And how long have you been on the bench? And okay. Then also, what is involved? What's your scope? What's your area that you oversee as far as common pleas judge?
You know, judge was never something I thought I'd want to do, quite honestly. In fact, I had a number of people over the years say, have you ever thought about being judge? And my response many times was, no. I enjoyed my practice. I enjoyed working with clients. We had a great rapport with my clients. It's probably one of the biggest challenges I have is having left the clients behind. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed that practice. I wasn't running away from anything. But a number of people on multiple occasions over several years had come to me and inquired about me becoming a judge. And I became more and more open to that idea. I prayed a lot about it. My wife and I prayed a lot about it, trying to figure out what is our calling, what is my calling. And to be quite candid, I simply decided, you know what, God, if this is where you want me to go, I will follow. You need to lead, but you need to really make it very, very clear. This is the direction you want me to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he put things in place. He put people in place to make that clear for me and my wife. And so it wasn't something I pursued so much as I think it called me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to be arrogant or egotistical. I just think I was open to a different perspective, even though perhaps it was uncomfortable. It was going to require some economic sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
But we were willing, and my wife was a big supporter of that, and certainly wouldn't have made that transition had she not been a supporter of.
And you
of
took
that.
Over the bench when?
Took over the bench January 1st of 2023, so I've been on the bench almost 2 years now.
Okay. And what all do you cover then?
Sure. So we basically have two common pleas judges in Dark County. I'm one of them, and Judge Aisinger is the second common pleas judge. I handle the general division, which handles criminal felonies and most civil matters, as well as the domestic relations component, divorces and dissolutions. Okay. Judge Aisinger handles probation and juvenile matters. And then Judge Monin, who's our municipal judge, she handles the municipal docket, which includes a lot of misdemeanors, traffic violations, citations. She would have a better description of all the kind of cases she handles. But getting back to, I handle the general division, felony crimes, most civil matters of significant value, and the domestic relations component.
Okay. Yeah. Do you ever worry about your personal security?
I try not to. In the introductory orientation programs presented by the Supreme Court to all new judges, that was one thing that they spent a lot of time trying to indoctrinate us new judges on the need to watch your personal security. I'm a man of faith, but I'm not stupid. I can't control everything. I can make good decisions. I can surround myself with good people. I have a great bailiff, Chip Roberts. We have a great law enforcement group. I have great security at the courthouse. There's been occasions where there's been threats, emails or other, whatever, and you back up and say, okay, is this truly somebody making a threat? Or are they just spouting off and they're angry at what the current outcome is of their situation? Luckily, there's been nothing that we've had to react to. But I take it seriously, but I don't get overwhelmed with it.
Mm-hmm.
It can paralyze you if that's your concern. And so I've avoided it having that kind of effect on me.
I would assume that Dark County doesn't have near the problems the bigger cities do and have. So what is probably the biggest problem you have to deal with?
Wow.
That must have been a good one.
Well, at the end of the day, it goes back to my comments earlier. Our goal, whether it's the court, the legal system in general, even the probation department, which I oversee, creating that change of attitude, change of behavior. And how do we do that on an individual basis? I'm limited to three things when I'm handing down a sentence. I can issue a fine, I can order supervision and treatment, or I can incarcerate somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can do. And so how do I use one or more of those to effectuate our goal, which is perhaps have an element of punishment, but also create deterrence and rehabilitation for the defendant? How do I do that? Using one or more of those three things on any particular, and we try very hard trying to figure out what is going to be this person's hot button, what's going to get them to change. It's frustrating when, I think the hard, getting back to your question about what's hard, it's hard when you don't see the change, when you want it more than they want it for themselves. When you see the opportunity that a young man or woman has and they turn to drugs, they turn to poor peer pressure, or they continue to hang out with people who are not going to get them where they really want to go. And it frustrates you because you can't control them. They're adults. They're not like children where you just put them in the corner, put them in timeout, or take their cell phone away from them. You like to be able to do some of those things sometimes, but mm-hmm. you sometimes can't. And so how do we, as a legal system, as a judicial system, effectuate that change of attitude, change of behavior mm-hmm. when it's so hard to do and accomplish, and then measure your accomplishments?
Has the drug problem in Dark County staying about the same, lessening a little bit, or what do you see happening in the future?
I think it's getting better. I think a significant number, more than 50% of the cases that come through my docket have a drug-related offense. Mm-hmm. Clearly more than 50%.
Wow.
We have some really great treatment programs. I have a great probation department. I have 8 probation officers. For a small community like this, that's unheard of. A lot of communities of 50 or 55,000 residents, Dark County would be, a lot of probation departments will have maybe 3 or 4. We have 8. Mm-hmm. We manage on that roster of probationers about over 200 folks who have been sentenced and now are on some type of probation or supervision.
Wow.
We have about over 100 people that are kind of what we call pre-trial supervision, meaning their case is processing, but they're still being supervised in some way, making sure they stay on the right track while their case is pending. So back to the drug problem itself, I think it changes. I think it's slightly getting better. We still have the influencers from Dayton, Ohio that we struggle with. Mm. Law enforcement would probably have a better feel for that situation. But I do know that we're trying to effectuate change. We've got, I'll give kudos to the counseling center down in Portsmouth, Ohio. We send a number of individuals down there, and they just do a fantastic job. Recovering wellness locally is a big help in us evaluating our people and what would be programs that would be beneficial to them. And then, of course, the probation staff. The probation staff, again, hats off to them. I say they're my Jedi masters. I labeled this the very first day I swore in, because they are the individuals in this community that deal with the dark side of society mm-hmm. every day. Mm. And so I kind of labeled them my Jedi masters, because that's their role.
Do you have one story in particular of a person that maybe was in your court for drugs maybe once or twice, and now they've gotten their life turned around, they've come back and told you about it?
Not yet, but I know it's in the works. I probably haven't been on the bench long enough to really have that that effect. I did take the probation department down to that counseling center in Portsmouth, Ohio a couple months ago, and we toured their campus, met with a number of their instructors, even met some of the individuals that had been up here and been sentenced, went down there as part of their treatment or probation, went through their treatment program, rehabilitation program, and have jobs down there, are working, are paying
wow,
rent.
That's good.
So we did meet some people that the system's working. But it gets back to, again, it only works for somebody who wants it to work for them.
Yeah.
So how do we incentivize them to have that change of attitude or change of behavior that gets them to the point where they're willing to change? And once they do, there's resources and programs out there to help them. Sometimes it's, you look at, okay, if someone's not willing to change, how do you incentivize that? Well, a concrete cell sometimes does that, mm-hmm. And so punishment or incarceration, whether it's prison or jail, sometimes is the component where, okay, I don't like that result, so I need to either change my thinking or change what I do, or I'm going to get that result next time again. And so sometimes that's the component that incentivizes them to change, the uncomfortableness of the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Mr. Warner, you've coached before. You understand, some kids, it's pain or pleasure, and you motivate someone by either rewarding them for good behavior or punishing them for bad behavior, and no different than an athlete.
You can lead a horse to water, but sometimes it's tough to make him drink.
And some of them need a
waterboarding,
a good swift kick.
Some need you to grab their face mask and yell at them a little bit, and other ones need just the tap on the back and say, you can do better.
So I've got 2 questions here. So are you ever frustrated by how you're limited according to what the law says? You'd like to do this, but you know that you're locked in certain parameters on what you can administer. And then the other part of that, then after you answer that, I'd like to know, what's your typical caseload like?
Sure.
Over the course of a week or month, whatever.
The law gives me a lot of flexibility in terms of sentencing. I don't know that I've been frustrated very often about I don't have on my table what I want to have. I think the challenge I maybe ran into on a few times is, let's say someone who's convicted of a felony of the fifth degree, which is a low-level felony, usually a drug case of some kind, but it's their 15th one. Okay? And so we're not, what are we going to do to change attitude, change behavior? It's kind of hard to impose a prison sentence on them. Usually it's local jail. Okay? But then our jail is so small. And the resources there, I hate overly burdening Captain Hawes or Sheriff Whitaker with the jail. They've been more than complimentary in terms of allowing us to, or they basically move people to Mercer County Jail or other adjacent counties to accommodate maybe our overflow. So they've been very accommodating. But, you know, having that resource, I think, is the ability to hold somebody, maybe even for a short period of time. Maybe they've just been arrested over the weekend and they're high still, or they're still under the influence. Being able to hold them for a few days and getting them to clean up, get in contact with legal counsel, be properly evaluated by Recovery and Wellness, see if there's something short term that we can get them on the right track, even while their case is pending, would be great. But I think I'm so limited in terms of that resource that the jail component may be the biggest challenge that I have. The biggest challenge I think law enforcement in general has in Door County.
And all these rules, regulations, the set comes from the state legislature, right? Is that where all the laws are established, and punishments and so forth?
So most of the laws that I'm dealing with, which are felonies, crimes that are felonies, almost I can't think of anything that would not have been originated from the General Assembly, okay, the legislature. I had a gentleman in the courtroom just yesterday, and we were going through a plea process. And his mandatory sentence is 3 years in prison. Okay, mandatory. I mean, I don't have discretion to give him less, even if I think or thought that that's overkill based on the offense. But the change doesn't come locally. The change doesn't even come to me. The change for something like that nature needs to originate in Columbus with the General Assembly to say this particular component needs to have a little more flexibility for the local judge to evaluate the situation. So that's one situation. But yeah, everything originates from felonious types of crimes. Everything relates, you know, flows from the state of Ohio and Columbus.
Do judges get a chance as a group maybe, or to go talk to the legislature about what, you know, you think is more fair? Or do they?
We've got a number of organizations, the Ohio Judicial Conference, the Supreme Court has a number of organizations within itself and committees. There's a great relationship with the legislature. But you have to understand, too, legislatures are there to satisfy constituents. And sometimes, for example, Marcy's Law. Marcy's Law is the right for a victim or victim representative to be notified of what is going on in a case that relates to them. Well, Marcy's Law has grown in its thumbprint over the last couple of years, and I can understand why. I mean, what legislature, state representative, state senator, is going to tell their constituents, their voters, no, we don't think you need more notice, or we don't think you need to be as involved in a case that affected you or you were a victim of? That's not likely going to happen with someone running for office needing to conjure up votes. But it really puts a huge burden on the prosecutor's office, law enforcement, and the court to provide notice and input and from victim or victim representatives, because they're still not a party to the case. The party is the state of Ohio and the defendant. We have a victim, no denying that, or an alleged victim, perhaps. But how much influence should that person have in a case for which they're not a party? I think has been a real challenge for, like I said, the prosecutor's office, law enforcement, and the courts.
So your typical caseload, how does that,
sure,
on an average week, say, for example? Like you're here with us this morning. I feel like we've gone through trial.
I'm sure that's the case.
In terms of structure, my Mondays and Thursdays are extremely busy. We've got a public defender group called ILAF, and their attorneys are in on Mondays and Thursdays, and we review all their cases on those days. So Mondays are full of cases. Every 10 or 15 minutes, there's a new one practically on Mondays and Thursdays. Tuesdays and Wednesdays are usually docketed for trial work. And so most of our jury trials are slated to happen on a Tuesday. And then Fridays are a lot of my civil work, whether it's conference calls or or pretrials with civil cases usually are slated for Fridays. Caseload-wise, for example, we may have anywhere from 3 to 9 jury trials scheduled on a single Tuesday.
Wow.
Okay. And the reason you do that is you don't know which ones are going to need continued, which ones are going to resolve by plea. Right. And so there's no way. I mean, if I have my docket on a case, I have about 300 new criminal cases a year.
Wow.
300 new civil cases a year and about 100 domestic relations cases a year, give or take. So approximately 700 new cases are flowing through my court on an annual basis. So there's no way you just, okay, this day is for this case. You build it deep, you know, 8 or 9 back, because you don't know where you're going to go. You need to be efficient with your time and the court's resources. So it's not uncommon for us to have 8 different trials scheduled for the day, but it's also not uncommon for all 8 to plea or get continued, and Tuesday is now open. And so I can do other things in the court, but I'm not in trial where I thought I would be.
Those 3 to 9 trial cases, is there a different jury pool for each one?
No, so what we typically do is about 14 days ahead of those trial dates, we pull a jury, meaning we send letters out to anywhere between 35 and 45 different potential jurors, have them come in, and we really don't know what case they're going to get until maybe the Friday before. At that point in time, we know, and we've got to let the lawyers know, you're up or you're not. But the jurors don't know if they're going to hear a civil case, a criminal case, who the defendant is. They really don't know that until they're in the courtroom and we're going through what's called voir dire and we're interviewing them and finding out who's my 12 that's going to sit in the box.
Yeah. Mike, have you ever been on a jury?
Yes, well, I was asked to be on one once. Excuse me, and I got thrown off because I knew one of the
How about you?
Lawyers. I was jury foreman.
You were really?
Yeah, it was a 3-day trial, and in fact, I would encourage people to don't look negative on being called for jury.
It was,
and I learned a lot being jury foreman. What I didn't realize is when the trial's over, they put you in the room. You're on your own.
Yep.
You make the decisions. And it was really interesting. We had 2 18-year-olds, an 8-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl. And it was really interesting to work with them. I mean, it's not that you enjoy it. It's a public service that you need to provide.
Yeah. And there's 2 types of juries. There's the Pettit jury, which is what you're describing, where they're deciding guilt or innocence, usually, of a particular defendant. But there's the grand jury.
Right.
The grand jury hears probable cause arguments from the prosecutor or law enforcement, say, hey, do we have probable cause to indict or charge this person? And a grand jury usually meets in my courtroom one Thursday a month, and it's usually 9 to 14 individuals that are coming in, and they're hearing all this evidence. But they can hear evidence on anywhere from 15 to 30 cases. And that's probably the one area where I think the community, those who have served in the grand jury, after that one day of service or 4 different days of service over several months, they appreciate, because that gave them a quick glimpse into what is going on in the community, what is law enforcement dealing with, what kind of challenges our judicial system has, because they get a real up close look at not just one case, but all the cases for that particular month.
Mm-hmm. You and I have a mutual friend and former Judge Mike Hall, mm-hmm. Second District Court of Appeals, and I know if a judge makes a decision and it gets appealed, it can get overturned. And I would think that's because it would be hard for a judge at your level to try to keep your personal opinion out of it. How hard is that?
It's not hard to keep my personal opinion out of a decision. Sometimes we just have a different perspective. I've been affirmed by the Court of Appeals already on a number of occasions. I've been overruled on a number of occasions. And mainly because perhaps it's not my opinion, but I view something as a jury would, and I'm not there yet. I'm not the jury. I'm the judge. I'm not the trier of fact. I'm the declarant of what the law is. And so that's probably where you get a little uncomfortable is you look at the facts and thinking, no jury in their right mind would agree with that. So I'm going to decide here. Well, it may be that, given deference to that side, they still have an issue of fact that the jury should decide, not the judge.
Have you been surprised before by, you think, well, the jury's going to rule this way, and all of a sudden, boy, out of the blue, Like when Galen was involved.
Yeah. you know, the first 9 months we had quite a few jury trials, and not one of them really surprised me. Okay. In terms of their outcome, in terms of guilt or innocence or liability. I'm not sitting here saying they got it right. That's not for me to have an opinion of. But I was of the same mindset based on the evidence I heard in court.
So you took over in January of 23. So you're coming up on 2 full years now. You have a 4-year term before you go back?
I have a 6-year term.
6-year term before you go back on the ballot.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Do you have to do homework? Do you take work home with you? I would think you would have to do a lot of research and studying on each case.
Not necessarily each case, unless they're, again, the court is only activated when it's asked to do something. So I, as a judge, only act on a case if there's been a motion or a request or an application sent. Now I want to know what the law is on a particular charge, so when it comes time to instruct the jury what the law is, I've done my research. But that doesn't take nearly as much time as there's a motion for example, summary judgment in a civil matter, and I've got to read through multiple depositions, multiple briefs, weigh both arguments. That requires a significant amount of research, and then come up with maybe I agree with this, but now are they citing the right case law? Is the case law they're citing really say what they say it says? And so I'm kind of double checking what the lawyers are telling me to make sure that they're being honest with the court as well. So there's a considerable amount of research. I've got a couple cases right now on my desk that will take, I was in the office quite a bit Sunday afternoon after church. I was in the office a little bit Saturday morning. So it ebbs and flows a little bit though. There'll be times where I don't have as much, and there'll be times I have 4 or 5 fairly large projects that require some extra time.
Okay. So, you know, I was just thinking, I was kind of envious of you two both having been on juries before. I've been a Dark County resident most of my life, and you know, I've only been slum under called twice, and both times is when we lived in St. Louis. And for some reason, they refused to fly me back to participate. I think it's either that, or they just maybe questioned my judgment anyhow.
No.
Not at all.
As we get ready to wrap things up, final question, Galen?
Would a new jail help our community? I know it's small. We have to send them out. That's expensive. Do we need a new jail?
I mean, I would be in support of that. I mean, that's a high dollar figure. Is it something that the community could do if there were some matching funds from the state of Ohio? That'd be the sweet spot. Much like when we built the Greenville High School, there was a big component of that came from state funding and local local taxpayer work. I think that'd be very, very helpful. Our jail has been modified and renovated to keep it compliant, but it is a dungeon. And again, jail is. I had one person come to me who didn't want to go to jail, and her comment was, "Well, I don't like that." Well, it's not vacation, okay? It's not designed to be a Hampton Inn or something like that, or Hampton Suites. It's not designed. But I think there's just a number of things in law enforcement would echo. I think there's a lot more things we could do in terms of those three things, or two of the three. Supervision or treatment and incarceration we could do if we had a bigger and better jail.
Yep. I do know the state of Ohio, again, in their budget, their capital budget for this year, they're going to put another $50 million out for the construction of jails and for the renovation of jails. I don't know what it would cost to build a jail for Dark County, probably somewhere in the $30 to $40 million range with what they would need with the pod system and tearing it all down and all that stuff. I know you get along really well with Sheriff Whitaker. He's very, very pleased with what you do. The jail situation we have here, it's pretty common throughout the state of Ohio for smaller jails, but I think we have one of the three smallest ones, don't we?
I think so. I don't know the statistics. Sheriff Whitaker would know really, really well. You know, I compare us to, let's say, Logan County and Bell Fountain. Logan County, I think, is a similar population, 50 or 55,000. I know Kevin Bragg, who's a common pleas judge up there. We were in Dinsmore together. But I think his jail holds 80, and our jail holds 36.
And Mercer County can hold 100, I think.
There was one time this past summer where there was as many inmates, I believe, from our county in Mercer County as we had in our own jail, just because of the overflow and the issues we were dealing with. So you know, I think there's some issues there that need to be addressed and evolved. County commissioners are going to be involved, but it's hard that the financial component is, it's a big ticket item. And how do you, it's not like building a school, my kids are going to go there and I want the best for them. People don't have that same attitude for criminals. And so I think that's part of the hard sell on that topic.
Yeah. Speaking of kids, we forgot to mention.
Yeah.
Two.
Yeah, so I'm a grandfather. My wife and I are grandparents over and again twice. Our daughter has a little boy now. It's going to be 18 months, and another boy who is almost 2 months. So about 14, wow. 15 months apart. So
put them close together.
Yeah, yeah. So they're a lot of fun.
Yeah,
they're
a lot of fun. Right.
They create joy in your life, no matter where you're.
My brother and I are 14 months apart, and look how I turned out.
Yeah, that's what worries me. Anyhow, hey, you know, we could go on because there's so much that this man could present, and we certainly know that the legal system's in good hands with Judge Fleeman and his cohorts up there at the courthouse and everything. And certainly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. We'll probably just about have to call a recess. So, which one of you gentlemen wants to hammer the gavel here and court's adjourned? Court's going to be adjourned? Anyhow, hey, thanks to Nick Schmidt for being our videographer today, Galen Blosser, Mike Stiegel, Alex Warner, and again, thanks to Common Pleas Judge Travis Fleeman for taking time out and enlightening the good folks of Dart County out here. And again, we just appreciate everything you folks do up there because that's a tough job and you guys are handling it very well. So.
Thank you.
Anyhow, so glad to have you with us here on this episode of the Roundtable. We'll be back sometime in the future as, again, we take a look at interesting things that take place in Greenville, Dart County, and West Central Ohio. Goodbye, everybody.